Eating Scotch Potatoes across the country, around the world, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr.
And I'm Brian Salisbury, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies.
That's right. Brian is a new guest host on the show. If you read some of the stuff that I write on Film School Rejects, you will, of course, have run into Brian's stuff. We'll actually talk to him in a minute. Before we do that, just so we don't get distracted and derailed here, let's go through the paperwork here. We've got go to fatguysofthemovies.com. That's where you can find this podcast and other podcasts and movie reviews, DVDs, and that sort of thing. You can go to iTunes and search Fat Guys of the Movies, and we'll pop right up and go ahead and subscribe to us. Write us a good review, 5-star reviews. We'll send you a scented, kissed envelope in the mail if you send us your email address to or snail mail address. You can go to facebook.com/FGATM and like our page. You can email us at fatguys@filmschoolrejects.com. We'll be reading one of those emails later in the show, and you can leave us a voicemail, 740-205-6456. And of course, you can get me on Twitter and yell at me by going to twitter.com/KevinCarr. And Brian, what's your Twitter handle, first of all?
It is Bry Guy Salisbury, just like the steak, just like delicious Bry Guy steak.
Are you slathered in delicious gravy with mushrooms?
I am, and you know what? I'm a little offended. When I was brought on the show, I was not told that it was a Fat Guy podcast. But more to the point, I was offended that you didn't go with my name for the podcast, which was Stocky at the Cinema. But you know what? You know, whatever. It's your show. You do whatever you want.
Well, I mean, when I said, hey, would you like to be on Fat Guys at the Movies, I thought that was pretty self-explanatory that it was for Fat
I thought
Guys.
It was just you and me going to the movies. I thought it was like that was your code for us going to the movies. But now I understand what it is I'm committed to.
There's like 7 states between us. I mean, it's like,
I'm not going to say I didn't think it was weird, but
let's meet in Memphis and we'll go see a movie.
Then eat some delicious barbecue.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it. Actually, you know, the last time I was in Memphis, I had crystals. Do you have crystals?
Because
you're in Texas, right? You don't have them down there.
No, we. You know what? When I was living in the Midwest, we had the glory that was White Castle.
White Castle, yeah.
I miss that so much.
Yeah, we have some friends that live in Dallas, and we've been down to visit them before, and they're from Ohio, and I think they're from Indiana initially, but they're from Columbus, Ohio, which is where we're from. Every time they come back into town, we try and see them and, you know, go hang out for a second. And the husband, he's like, oh, I always have to get some White Castles. And of course he pays for it later.
Because
he loves White Castles. He just, his body isn't used to them.
That's part of the fun of going to White Castle is the crippling bowel distortion later.
Yes. I call it a White Castle hangover because White Castles only taste good. They do not taste good at like 2 p.m. I mean, they're okay, but they taste best at like 3 a.m.
This is very, very true. And in fact, I was at Convergence, which is in Minnesota recently, mm-hmm. and got drunk. And on the way back, the guy I was staying with is like, you know, there's stuff that's open. There's McDonald's, I think the KFC still open. There's a White Castle. I was like, I'm sorry. What did you just say?
What? And I've been drinking and you didn't immediately take me to the White Castle?
I'm like, I'm not even sure why we're having a discussion right now. You can turn this car around and you go to White Castle. You do it.
Well, you know, White Castle has the same effect on you as Taco Bell, because the other day I had Taco Bell for lunch, and then we had leftover Taco Bell for dinner, and then I watched Batman Forever. So it was just, was not a good combination.
All kinds of things that cause diarrhea.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyways, Brian, tell us who you are, where you're from, obviously from Texas area, but what you do, and because we are sort of both writers for Film School Rejects, but you know, you do a bunch of other things too.
Yeah, I'm kind of an internet gadfly, as it were. I'm a journo and a movie critic, and I write for, in addition to Film School Rejects, Hollywood.com, Spill.com, do a little work with Movies.com, Fandango, and you can also catch me from time to time on Culture Map.
Wow, that's all over the place, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much all over the place. Like, just type in internet and my name, and you're bound to find something.
That's awesome. Or just type your name into the internet.
Yeah, well, no, if you type internet into the internet, you actually break the internet.
Really? It just blows up?
Yeah, it's a backdoor nobody knows about.
Yeah, well, there you go. But you do, for Film School Rejects, do you mostly, I know you do junk food cinema, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's your baby.
Yes.
What other stuff do you do? Do you just pick up other things, or is that just pretty much your...
Well, I pick up a lot of, you know, just kind of one-off articles. I did cover Comic-Con this year. That was a lot of fun. I actually went as Rorschach, so did sort of a Rorschach's journal of what was going on at Comic-Con in the voice of that character. It was a lot of fun.
Did you wear the mask the whole time?
I did. Yes, indeed.
Was it hot?
It actually, the mask wasn't too bad. I had it specially made by a place here in Austin that does great work called Lucy in Disguise. But the rest of the costume, the scarf and the trench coat, is what was killing me.
That's a bit rough to be doing in San Diego. Did you just cover the floor, or did you actually go into like Hall H?
We did. I did a lot of floor stuff. I waited 4 hours on one day to get into Hall H and caught the last half hour of, and then didn't get a chance to get into anything else. So mostly it was just hanging out on the floor and talking to people.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I have a love-hate relationship with Comic-Con because on one hand, I just love the experience. It's this mecca of geekdom, and it's just so intense, and so many things are happening, and there's so many cool people that you can hang out with. But if I'm going to go to Comic-Con, I kind of have to do work.
Yeah.
And that kind of just makes, I don't want to work.
Yeah.
And I went in 2007 and 2008, and I was part of covered it for FSR both times. And we did video editing and stuff. Me and Fury, Robert Fury, were doing video interviews and that sort of thing. And I had to edit stuff together. So I was like chained to my computer in my hotel room half the time editing stuff because he couldn't edit it 3 weeks later.
Right.
Nobody cares. but I mean, it was that thing that, and so people are like, are you going to go to Comic-Con? I go, no, because I would do no work. I would just hang out with people and it would be a complete waste of money.
Yeah, man. It's a grind, man. When you're actually covering it, it is definitely a grind.
Oh, and it kills your feet and you're on. And then I was like this, it was like Saturday. I had my Twitter open, my TweetDeck open, and I'm seeing people going, oh my gosh, the line for Hall H like wraps all the way down to Tijuana and back. And I was like, I'm kind of glad I'm not there.
I'm fairly certain you could have opened my front door here in Austin and gotten in line for Hall H on
Probably,
Saturday.
Yeah. It was huge.
It was nuts.
Yeah. So, that's good. That's good. I actually stepped in and one or two junk food cinemas. For when you were on vacation or something.
That is correct. Yeah, I've had some guest writers this month just because I've done Convergence and then Comic-Con, and then I'm leaving bright and early tomorrow morning for Montreal to do Fantasia. So I'm kind of all over the place this month. So.
Wow. Well, good luck for you on that. That'll be fun. Anyways, we are going to talk a little bit about, was there anything, since you mentioned Comic-Con, is there anything you kind of want to, throw out there? What's your best? We got about a minute or so left here.
I think meeting Terry O'Quinn was one of my, and it's a really weird thing. Like, I don't so much have an affinity for him on Lost as I do in the Stepfather movies from the late 80s.
Did he murder you, or at least try to murder you?
No, but he was really shocked that anyone remembered the Stepfather. You know, when I told him that's what I was a fan of, he just kind of turned around, looked at me, and went, wow, that's an old one.
How can you not? I mean, the Stepfather, I mean, they remade it, the awful remake with Dylan Walsh like a couple years ago, but at least it kind of came back into the movie idea. It's not like he did like Cannibal Holocaust.
Right, exactly. And in fact, I even like Stepfather 2, which was like the one where him and it was like Meg Foster from Masters of the Universe, or not from Masters, from
Crazy Eyes.
Yeah, she was in They Live, and she was great. And I like both of the first two. I even kind of like the third one, but it doesn't have him in it. But,
She was in Blind Fury.
Yes, in Blind Fury. And it's one of those things. It was like, that was a celebrity that, you know, most people would either not care to meet, or they would be like, oh, he was on Lost. But for me, it was just such a thrill to meet the guy from The Stepfather.
that's who you geeked out over.
Totally, man.
Well, you know, I'll tell you who I geeked out at on Comic-Con like 10 years ago. But we got to go to a break between now and then. And when we come back, my embarrassing story. And welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We've got Brian Salisbury here talking a little bit about Comic-Con, and he was telling me how he geeked out over Terry O'Quinn, which I totally get that. And geeking out over him for something obscure.
Totally.
Too, which is that's gotta be flattering. What I found with celebrities is if you kinda like either geek out about something or reference something that's old and obscure, they either are very flattered or they're really weirded out.
Yeah, or they're like really like put off by it. Like, really, of all the things that I've done?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I once interviewed, I've interviewed Bruce Campbell a couple times. And one time when I interviewed him, I brought up like all his like short films he did with Sam Raimi. Like not just Watcher in the Woods, but like Toro and stuff like that. And he just, it was like, it was like it just was so dismissive about it because he's like, I don't want to talk about that.
See, I thought you were going to say you brought up Briscoe County Jr. and
I interviewed this when I interviewed him. It was like 2000. So Briscoe County Jr. was, he was actually still had fans from that were,
oh, nice.
That were pretty common. It was before Burn Notice. So, you know, he was just tired of hearing about Evil Dead. but I was at Comic-Con in 2002 and 2003 and with a bunch of friends, and we were doing stuff. We were like, this is before bloggers even existed really. And people really started covering it in that sense. And so we were doing like some funny little short films type stuff. And I had a friend of mine with me who was very green, very, very, very young and new. And I told him, I said, if you meet a celebrity, don't geek out over him. Don't be an idiot. Don't gush over him. Don't ask for autographs.
Just be cool. Just be a normal person.
They're a human being, you know? And so we walk in and we come through and they're at a tiny little booth. I mean, I'm like talking like one of those card table booths, like smaller than where they'd sell comics.
Like Lucy's psychology booth from the Peanuts kind of a booth.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was really, really tiny and in this obscure, weird section. And there sitting in there was Don Coscarelli promoting Boba Hotep.
Nice.
And it was before Boba Hotep really anybody knew about it. He was promoting. And like I said, he was around the corner from the Lord of the Rings booth, but like in the corner. And so he wasn't even the normal place. I think he got the booth himself. And I went up there and I just geeked all over this guy.
Right.
Because of Phantasm.
Oh, and yeah. Just like, Phantasm, oh, and Beastmaster. And there's so many reasons to love this guy.
Yeah. And Bubba Hotep too, but I hadn't seen it by that dude.
Right.
And I just, and I mean, he was just like, because at that time it was like this weird time because Bubba Hotep really kind of brought him back into the stream of things. And by that time, you know, Phantasm was kind of just was obscure at that time. And he didn't know how to react to it. I think he was scared. So then my friend says to me after, he's like, yeah, don't geek out. I'm like, don't use that as an example.
You scared Don Coscarelli? You scared the guy who made Phantasm?
I think I may have a little bit.
That's not easy to do.
Well, I think I was very into, I'm like, oh my God, I love Phantasm. And it was reminding me of the time, you know, scaring people. Back in, I think it was 2008, when I covered it for FSR, and Neil Miller, the editor, he was getting pictures with a bunch of people, and Cody Miller was taking pictures, who was doing some stuff like that. And so there's a picture of him with Frank Miller, because Frank Miller was there promoting The Saint at the time.
Oh.
And fat lot of good that did. But but there's this picture of Neil, like, right next to Frank, and Neil's very laid back in his pictures, but you know, he's a big guy. And Frank Miller looks horrified. I mean, he looks terrified because I don't know what happened beforehand. And I pointed out, I go, you scared Frank Miller. This guy is a creepy guy. And you managed to creep him out.
That's impressive. That is very impressive. And, you know, Don Coscarelli, one of the greatest things that I think I've ever done is I got to lead the Q&A for John Dies at the end when I played at South by here.
Okay.
And just kind of hang out with him and ask him a bunch of questions. And it was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I love filmmakers that don't have total success.
Yeah, no, totally.
Because they're very humble and usually easy to get along with, especially if they've been around for 30, 40 years, like Coscarelli has.
Very true.
So, but speaking of characters that have been around for 30, 40, 90, 100 years or whatever. What is 1938 was when Batman was created?
1939, Detective Comics number 27.
That's right, Detective Comics number 27. We have the new Batman movie, Dark Knight. The Dark Knight Rises. Christopher Nolan directs this modest independent film about a strong man facing off against a guy who likes to dress up as a fuzzy little animal.
Did they kill him?
I'm not sure.
Huh. Why didn't you just kill me?
Your punishment must be more severe.
Do you think he's coming back?
I don't know.
You should be as afraid of him as I am.
I won't bury you. I've buried enough members of the Wayne family.
Wait, right, whoa, so... whoa, what movie did you see? I'm confused.
It was just a sweet little independent movie.
Wait, a fuzzy little animal? A
fuzzy little animal. Yeah, a bat. Bats are fuzzy. Cute and cuddly. Anyway, so here we go. We've got The Dark Knight Rises. You've seen it. In fact, we both have seen it tonight. First, I want to give you first crack at it. What did you think of it?
Well, you know, it's weird. Like, there's something about it that seems very jarring at first, especially in the first act. And then as it gets going and starts to get into its groove, you realize that it can't, by the nature of what it is, follow a formula like Dark Knight did. It has to be a little bit more complicated and a little bit more disjointed in order to make the story work. And I think that they told an incredible Bane story and an incredible incredible story that digs into the metaphorical meat of what this character really is. And Batman is my all-time favorite comic book character, and I think that they nailed pretty much everything about not only him, but the characters that surround him and you know, how that plays out with Gotham. So I really did like it a lot.
Okay. Did you get a chance to see it in IMAX?
I did, yes.
Okay. See, I was really disappointed when they showed it, because they showed it in 35mm. Which, not even digital, and it was, like, framed wrong and, like, out of focus, and the sound was crappy.
I don't know. I'll give you if it was framed wrong and out of focus, but, I mean, I'm a huge fan of 35, so to me, complaining that it was in 35 is like speaking Greek. Like, I don't understand what you're saying.
Well, complaining that it was in 35 and not IMAX.
Okay. Well, yeah. I'll give you that.
Yeah. That's. I mean, and even though it's a digital IMAX screen, it's still... It was the one movie that I wished... That I see, I'm going to go back and see it again in IMAX, and the presentation was bad. And like, even at the real change, it was like, you know, and like started discoloring. You got cigarette burns and everything like that, which are cool to see at times, but it just didn't feel like it was given. At least the presentation at my local theater wasn't, you know, it wasn't given the care.
Yeah, it sounds like the 15-year-old in the booth didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm wondering if that colored my impression of it a little bit, because I was actually a bit underwhelmed by it. Part of it is coming off The Dark Knight. And The Dark Knight was such a great movie and so well constructed. And even though it's 2.5 hours long, it doesn't feel like it. This one's 2 hours and 45 minutes, and I felt every minute of that. Hmm. It felt long. It felt like, you know, Nolan's had a string of really big hits. And Warner Brothers was like, well, we can't tell them to make it shorter. You know what I mean? And that's where I felt. I felt that the cast was a little crowded. It has a great cast. I mean, the actors are all great. And they all do a fantastic job. So there's that. There's like pluses like that. You know, you have that. And it's got some good action sequences in it. For me, the downside was it was hard to not... Like, it was hard for Bane to not be derivative of the Joker at times. And just not do as good of a job. Because the Joker was just so incredible in the Dark Knight, and also just it felt very, I don't know, it just was crowded. There were like characters, like for example, there's a character played by Matthew Modine. They could have lost him.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is with that character, like I feel like the greatness of it and the way that he balances them so well is like he's in there for the briefest of moments, but that story is well-rounded and well-told. It's just, you know, microcosmic of everything else that's going on. Yeah. And the thing with Bane is that I don't feel like he's derivative of the Joker, because I feel like the Joker had...
His plot was derivative.
I don't agree. I feel like what he was wanting to do was on such a larger scale than what the... I mean, the Joker is an agent of chaos as well, but the Joker's chaos is you know, very much like that character. It's just kind of played as a lark for him. Like, as psychotic as he is, everything that he does in his mind is a lark. And Bane is all business. And Bane has much, much larger aspirations than the Joker did. And I feel like they fleshed that out really well with Tom Hardy.
Yeah, I mean, I do think... I don't know. I mean, there's issues I have with Bane. I think he sounds like... I don't know why he sounds like the guy on YouTube who's doing the Fresh Prince song as Ian McKellen.
To me, that is to me entirely the studio's fault.
Batman. And I don't know if that was like a secondary decision, because
they got so much flack for that. They threw such a big fit after the initial footage came out that you couldn't understand Bane. You couldn't understand. Yeah. So the studio made him go back and remix that audio, and it's like, Well, yeah. It would have worked better the way they had it the first time, so that is entirely the studio's fault.
Yeah. All right. Well, actually, on that, we're going to have to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about The Dark Knight Rises.
22 miles of hard road, 33 years of tough luck, 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck.
Oh, yeah.
What are you?
I'm Gotham's Reckoning.
When a couple of guys who are up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood.
Why didn't you just kill me?
Your punishment must be more severe.
Your home spare you later.
And welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We are now in the infamous middle segment where Brian is allowed to swear if you want to.
What the front door?
Oh my gosh, you can't even, you don't even do it.
I will. No, I will. I will when it's in the moment, but.
You're like, I will when we get to the last segment.
No, totally. Also... when I can't, when I'm not supposed to. But the thing is, it's like, you know, for an actor crying on cue, I can't swear on cue. It has to be organic. Oh.
Okay, no, that makes sense. You got to work up into the method.
Fucking A.
Everything. There you go. Anyways, we're talking a little bit about, a lot about The Dark Knight Rises. And I guess part of the thing is, it's, I felt the same way I felt about, like, King Kong, the Peter Jackson's King Kong, where I'm like, it's a good movie.
So you didn't like the scene where Tom Hardy climbed the Empire State Building? Because that was my favorite.
Well, it was great. And then when he grabbed Naomi Watts, yeah. And then Jack Black was like, Beauty killed the Beast. No, but, so, I mean, it's a good movie. And that's, I guess I have to preface that because The Dark Knight was so incredible. And I just recently went back, as most people in our industry have, and gone back and watched Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. And The Dark Knight holds up 100%. You know, it's 4 years old, but I mean, it's not like 30 years old.
Yeah,
but I mean,
yes, considering the great cultural changes in the last 4 years, it really holds up.
Yeah, but no, I mean, it still works. Batman Begins, I still have serious problems with. And I'm like, I don't know. And I have these issues with Batman Begins. I felt this much the same way about Batman Begins or about The Dark Knight Rises as I did about Batman Begins. In that it's still a good movie. It's kind of like that 3 out of 5 star movie for me. It's still a recommend, but I just have are you still there?
I'm here. Yep.
Okay. I just have some issues with it. And you know, some of the issues, I mean, like I said, and you're right. Obviously they changed Bane's voice to be me more. It just may not have been the best choice. I think Nolan's not good at choosing voices. Because I've always had an issue with the Batman voice.
See, I hear so that all ridiculous. The time, and I don't know, man. It's still, like, and I don't know how much you've read the comic books, but, like...
I read them crazy up until about the mid-90s.
Yeah, there's just something about that doesn't feel forced to me. Something about that is, like, what the hell else is he... Like, if he made it any more obvious that he was Bruce Wayne, you know, the villains would just come knocking at Wayne Manor instead of worrying about waiting for Batman to come to them. So it's like he's got to do something to disguise his voice. And it's like, it's either go gravelly or be like, hello, I'm Batman. I'm going to wake you up now.
Hey. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a difference between that and like George Clooney when he played Batman and Batman and Robin. There's many problems with that movie. But George Clooney is just George. He's just talking like Batman, just talking like Bruce Wayne. There's no, I understand there's a point of, there's no attempt to disguise a voice. I just don't think... Christian Bale's a great actor.
Are you actually trying to say that Christian Bale should have gone the George Clooney route from Batman and Robin?
No, 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 no.
Because I will quit this podcast right now.
I'm just saying it would have been. It just I still think that the raspy voice is silly. That's all I'm saying. Is I think maybe if it had been modulated or something like that, maybe it just goes in a deeper voice. I don't know. It almost seems too. That's the part. That I zero in on is too cartoony. And I felt that with Bane. Every time Bane talked, it was like, there's a scene in Batman Forever, because I just watched that, where the Riddler goes, Batman, Batman. And that's exactly the way Bane sounded to me through the entire movie. And I know it's complete coincidence, but it's just, it wasn't too jarring. It's just when they had conversations with each other, it just got really silly.
I mean, I guess maybe I noticed that a little bit in the first act, but I felt like it was reined in by the time Bane was doing things that you didn't give a crap what he sounded like because he was roughing people up big time.
Yeah. Well, and here's, this is my other thing with Bane. There's a couple points in the movie. I'm trying to talk around this because I don't want to be spoilery. But there's a couple points in the movie where they don't explain something and like totally have the opportunity to, and like they don't explain. They do a really shoddy job of explaining who Bane is and why he's the way he is. They explain some of it, but then there's this giant gap that they're missing. You know, the superhuman strength or something like that. They actually do. I know you're going to hate me for this. I thought they did a better job in Batman Forever, as stupid as that was, or Batman and Robin, as stupid as that movie was. At least it explained why Bane was the way he was.
Yeah, no, you're right. They explained it and gave the absolute wrong explanation. Oh, Kevin Carr! Come on, man.
I never read the books with Bane in it, so I don't know. I mean, Bane was not. I missed that.
What they get right is that it was called venom that was coursing through him, and that's all they get right.
Anyways, no, I'm not saying that Bane is better in Batman and Robin, because he's not. He's a rubbery cartoon.
Because they would revoke your right to say anything about movies at all if you actually made that statement.
But all I'm saying is they literally explained why Bane is who he is in The Dark Knight Rises, but they like just like leave this thing out. And there's another scene in there where a certain character basically says, "Oh, I know you're talking to Bruce Wayne. I know you're Batman. How do you know I'm Batman?" And never explains it.
I will give you that. That did confuse me a little bit, because he literally just like opens up a conversation with, "Hey, by the way, I've always been a big supporter of the Batman. What's with the mask?" And it's like, "Whoa, hey, what?
What? How do you know?" And then he doesn't explain how he knows. He's just like, because if he gives this long, very emotional explanation that in no way explains why he's Batman.
Yeah. But to me, it's like, that kind of stuff is just nitpicky. Overall, like, I thought that what they did well is, first of all, the relationship between Batman and Catwoman was perfect.
Like, it was good. Actually, that was a great relationship.
That
I thought
shaky
they did a great
partnership
job.
That, like, very reluctant kind of, like, we have.
She gets a little cheeky at times with her lines, but I can forgive those.
Well, yeah, and again, I mean, that kind of depends on which Catwoman you read, because some of them were really super cheeky, and that makes sense to me. But I do like the fact that it was, like, even when they had a common enemy, their partnership was really shaky.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, she was never, if you read the comics, rarely is Catwoman a complete villain.
No,
Catwoman's
she's not
always
a super villain.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what she's about.
Yeah, they cross paths, and he kind of has to take her down occasionally in the comics, but it's just because he's like, well, that's my job. I mean, and then there's the other big thing is, and again, I'm not going to get spoilery, and this is my beef with, but this is my beef with Christopher Nolan and Jonathan Nolan, is they're like 95% really good writers, and then 5% total shit. And I'll use it as an example with Inception. Inception's a fantastic movie, except for the biggest cliche in the history of science fiction writing endings. That goes back to the Twilight Zone and EC horror comics and sci-fi comics. The cliche ending of Inception is a huge sticking point for me.
Wow, I completely disagree. I disagree, that the ending's cliche. I think the ending is completely
It was all a dream, or was it? Is the ending of spoiler if you haven't seen Inception, but that's the ending. It was all a dream, or was it?
No, that's not. It's not a question mark on the screen. What it is, yeah, is it's like they've given you all of the evidence you need to make the decision, and then they leave it to you to take that last step. It's not like they're
It's literally Lady or the Tiger, which is like one of the oldest stories in the book.
I don't know about that, dude. Like, I think that all the evidence is there to support that it's not at all a dream. And if you actually watch that thing, it does wobble. But it's like, it's not going to do you the disservice of spelling every single thing out for you that at that point you should be able to figure out on your own. I think
I like that ending a lot. See, that has always bothered me because I think it is. It was all a dream, or was it? It wobbles, but it doesn't fall. Yeah. And Nolan has gone on record and saying, well, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't. That's because you already know it's not a dream.
Not really. No, I think I don't want to get into the big argument of it. I personally think the whole thing's a dream. I think everything in Inception's a dream. And I have a whole reason, but I'm not going to go into that because I'm not falling for that stupid, because that's the trap. It's like, oh, I'm going to get people to talk about it. And that's one of the things, that was my biggest beef with Inception. When it comes to The Dark Knight Rising, there's a plot point that is the biggest cliche that I've ever seen. And I remember I got to a point where I'm watching this and I go, oh gosh, I hope this doesn't happen. Not because I was invested in anything that was happening in the movie. I'm just like, because that would be the biggest cliche I've ever seen. And then this thing happens, and I'm like, oh, jeez. I'm talking around it.
Yeah, I honestly have no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
I'll tell you what it is on the break.
Okay.
But no, I mean, there's a part in there where I'm just like, see it coming a mile away, and it's meant to be this big, you know, catch. And I'm just like, ah. But so those are the things. And it just, ultimately, I just thought that it really peaked with The Dark Knight, and then there was a huge step down with The Dark Knight Rises. There's some great things in it, and it's still a good movie. But it's overcrowded, it's overwritten, it's too long, but it's still worth seeing.
Oh, I don't know. I don't agree with a lot of what you're saying, other than that it's worth seeing and that it's... a Batman movie. Like, I don't really, like, I'm trying to think of what else that, you said that I agree with.
It's also kind of not a Batman movie through, like, two-thirds of it. For a Batman movie, there's not much Batman in it.
So you've taken away one of the only two things I could agree with you on. Okay, so yeah, it's worth seeing. I agree with Kevin Carr that it's worth seeing.
Anyways. See, I think it's, I'm curious to see what's sort of like the mainstream reaction is.
Yeah.
Because it's so funny, because it's made such news. People are like, and I don't mind having a debate with somebody who's seen the movie.
Right.
And we can disagree, and that's wonderful and all. What I can't stand are the people that are like, no, fuck you, this is going to be a great movie, and they've never seen it.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous, man. The way the internet's gotten, and the biggest problem of all is that you have all these sites with comment sections that require absolutely no registration. So you have total anonymity to say whatever the hell you want, and people are using that to be so hateful and so ugly. And you're right. You have people that are defending the movie and threatening the lives of people that don't think it's great, and they haven't even seen it.
They haven't seen it, and it's like, but and the thing is, even if you do, there's movies every year. There's movies that any particular person, I don't care who you are, if you're a critic and you're in our field, if everyone loves it, you're going to find some movie that you don't like. You know, there are people out there who fucking hate The Artist.
Right.
There are people there who hate that movie. I'm sure there's, I mean, and that's not one that's going to like polarize people on the internet, but I run into that all the time. And there are movies that I don't particularly like that are like, I didn't like The Social Network. I didn't like The Fighter particularly. So there are these movies that I don't particularly like. And I'm sure there's movies of yours that you'll watch and people are like going gaga over. And you're like, I didn't think it was that good.
Yeah, no, that happens. Yeah. Although it didn't happen to me with The Artist to be honest, I haven't seen Social Network or The Fighter. So I don't know where I would land on that. But I loved The Artist. So
yeah. Well, that's, I mean, I thought it was charming. I thought it was overhyped. My biggest beef with The Artist was it was the industry completely falling for the Harvey Weinstein spiel. It's like Harvey Weinstein comes out and goes, this is the greatest movie of the year. You will vote for the Academy. And I'm like, when I saw The Artist, I was like, oh, it's a charming, wonderful, sweet movie. It's not the best of the year. It's kind of how I felt with The Artist.
Well, I don't know. I don't think the Weinsteins need to do that anymore, considering their checkbook is enormous once it comes to award season. So,
well, but that's what they do every year. They did that with that. They did it with The King's Speech. Again, The King's Speech is a good movie.
Well, no, they opened their checkbook and saw, like, they totally bought The King's Speech. Like, every Oscar they got that year was purchased. None of the Oscars they got that year were earned. Not a single one of them.
Yeah.
That's my take on it, is that they, because it's all about campaigning. It's just like a presidential election, man. And the more money you have to put into that campaign, the more likely it is that you're going to win. And the Weinsteins have deep pockets. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, I think it's more than that. I think there's a they play to the mentality of the Academy in particular. I mean, there's a reason why The Artist won the Oscar and it wasn't winning every other award out there. It wasn't this ubiquitous award that like every, like there are years where like certain movies win all the awards, whether they're the Independent Spirit Award or the Oscars. They kind of, these movies, some movies tend to sweep.
Right.
And The Artist didn't. And I don't, and The King's Speech didn't. So I don't know. I getting back to The Dark Knight and those movies, I think that and sort of like the for lack of a better term, the fanboy support.
Mm-hmm.
I use that term really loosely, but it's, I think there are some people who just, they have this impression that Nolan can do no wrong, and I'm not a huge fan of Nolan. I think his movies are good, but I'm not, there's only a couple of them that I think are great movies. I think most of his movies are okay. You know, like The Prestige. Prestige is a good movie. It's not great. You probably love The Prestige. Are you a Nolan fan?
Well, no. Well, it's not that I love The Prestige because I love Christopher Nolan. I love The Prestige because my eyes work and I can watch the movie and see that it's great. Like, I don't...
No, but... Well, no, what I'm saying is there are some people who really, really dig Christopher Nolan. I mean, let me ask you this. Have you seen all of his movies?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay. Would you consider all of them great movies?
No, I think Insomnia is very mediocre. But
okay, all right. Well, there's a good one. I also think that's kind of mediocre.
Yeah.
You know, I thought Following was really clever.
And Following is a great first outing. I mean, like, you have so many filmmakers who would kill to be able to say that a movie like Following is their first movie.
Yeah, and then he follows it up with Memento, and Memento's brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, then you got stuff like Batman Begins, which I think is good, but I think part of Batman Begins, there's a lot more going on internally with Batman Begins that he couldn't make what he... I think what he wanted to make was something like The Dark Knight. He couldn't with the Batman Begins. And that's one of those movies where I think... working off of somebody else's script was a little detrimental to him, and working under what the studio thought a Batman movie should be caused some problems. Minor problems, but they're there.
I really think what we're going to end up having to do once this is all said and done
is arm wrestle.
Well, no, I mean, you and I are going to like grease up and fight. No, what I mean is, like, as fans of the franchise, is we're going to have to watch them all together. Like, I kind of feel like this is one enormous story. And I feel like they're going to complement and benefit one another when viewed simultaneously or back to back to back. So I don't know. Like, part of me wonders if, you know, watching Batman Begins and then The Dark Knight and then The Dark Knight Rises is going to, you know, uplift and maybe even solve some of the issues that we have with the bookends. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll be interesting to. I'm going to go check it out in IMAX next week because. I took one of my sons. I have two sons that are old enough to see them. I have a 4-year-old. You want to take a 4-year-old to this movie?
Not really.
Not because it's any violent or anything. They'd just be running around the theater because it's 2 hours.
Well, yeah, it deals with a lot of like metaphorical stuff that a kid that age is just going to be like, I don't know, Batman.
Yeah, they'll be just like running around. I mean, I saw a lot of people bringing young kids into the screening, and then the rep goes, it's going to be 3 hours long. And people are like, what? And I'm like, okay, how could you not know that?
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, the Dark Knight was 2.5, so it's not like it's not like this one's much longer than the Dark. It just felt longer to me. But I'm gonna bring I brought one of my sons because we were allowed only one guest. I brought one of my sons to tonight, and I'm gonna go check it out again in IMAX, properly projected. Well, LIMAX, but it's still better than just, you know, regular old projection. Because I saw the Dark Knight in both IMAX and regular projected in the theater relatively close, and it is a huge difference with that large format presentation and it being presented properly. So I'm going to take my other son to go see that. I'm curious to see whether my opinion changes.
Right. No, because, I mean, it warrants a second viewing for sure.
Yeah. And who knows, maybe I'll like it better. It's like Batman Begins. What's funny with Batman Begins, I saw it, what, 7 years ago when it came out, and I think I only saw it once in the theaters. I may have watched it once on DVD when it came out, but it's been, you know, for all intents and purposes, I saw it in 2005, and that was it. And I watched it again a couple weeks ago. Exact same opinion. I went back and read my review. I'm like, I'm saying the exact same things. You know, I mean, still, The Dark Knight Rises is one of the best Batman movies they made. But that's because you're throwing in Batman and Robin and Batman Forever into the mix. And Batman the movie from 1960.
I don't know. I like Batman the movie from 1960.
Yeah, sometimes you can't get rid of a bomb.
Sometimes you just can't get rid of a bomb.
That's a great movie. Very different, though.
Oh, yeah. I would say kind of different, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one I want to see again. And unfortunately, I have to stay off of Twitter. I was really avoiding Twitter and Facebook over the last week, trying to skirt around it, because there's just, and it pisses me off that I'm in an industry where I'm literally seeing the movie, you know, a day or a couple days before the majority of people in the world are going to see it. And I still have to avoid spoilers.
Oh, dude, I had the entirety of the movie spoiled for me.
Really?
And it wasn't Twitter. I was very careful about Twitter, but I co-host a podcast on Spill.com called Remote Viewing. And one of the reasons I really like Spill is that, by and large, their commenters are really decent people. They're very, you know, considerate and polite, and even when they disagree, they're very, you know, whatever. And then in this comment section, some guy who had just created a profile that day went to the comment section of every single podcast and just posted a list of things that happened.
What a dick.
And I could not believe it. I went in and I completely deleted his account, and I was so pissed off because he literally just went point by point. Like, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens. But still, knowing where it was going to go, I still enjoyed it a lot. And I think that speaks highly of the movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, but I got to stay off Twitter for the next week anyways, because I don't want any Step Up Revolution spoilers.
Right? Oh, my God. Dropping. How great does that movie look?
I have to say, I do have a soft spot for the Step Up movie.
Oh, I am unironically a fan of the Step Up movies. Like, I don't give a shit what their plot is about, but the dance sequences are so unbelievably spectacular that I can't help but love them.
And they do all the 3D stuff now. Not like the secondary dance movies. Like, what was the Honey? I got on Blu-ray. Universal sent me Honey 2.
Ugh.
Which just doesn't have. It is so sad to sit there. I mean, that's kind of like shopping at the supermarket and finding like generic luncheon meat because it's cheaper than Spam.
Yeah.
Be like, it just doesn't hold up to the quality, high quality standards of Spam.
Exactly.
It's kind of what I feel like when I watched Honey 2. It's not quite the quality.
It's good, but it's not dancing Spam.
Yeah, it's not brilliant. So yeah, so I have to avoid Twitter and Facebook for that because, you know, I don't want to.
Well,
will they dance?
Yeah, it's like, what are they going to spoil? Like, oh shit, that guy danced. Like,
will they make a statement? will they start a revolution by dancing?
See, I think that was one of the things I kept thinking about watching Dark Knight Rises. Is like, I wonder if Bane's organization is really just a giant flash mob, and any moment they're going to start dancing.
That would have been awesome.
That's the director's cut. I feel
that would be, that, I would watch that in a heartbeat. Although I will say this, the trailers for The Dark Knight Rises are very spoilery.
They really are.
Like, really spoilery.
It's gotten to the point where I try to avoid trailers as much as possible. The unfortunate part is that I write news for a website and post trailers and have to comment on them, so it's kind of hard to comment on them without watching them.
Yeah, I avoid trailers. I avoided Prometheus, anything Prometheus I avoided, which was tough.
Yeah.
And I avoided, I saw the first trailer of the Avengers, and then I stopped everything before I saw the Avengers, and it's better for it, because then I went back and I watched the trailers. Same thing with Prometheus. They give away the whole goddamn plot in the trailer.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, and there's stuff that happens in the trailer if you watch the first not the teaser that came out last year, because that didn't give shit away. That you're totally safe on watching that one from last summer, which just shows Gordon on a hospital bed and one shot of Batman putting up his dukes.
Yeah.
And that was it. But the football one.
Yeah, that's such a great set piece. I really wish they hadn't spoiled that.
Yeah, and they like spoil it all. And then that stupid little kid singing this national anthem. I wanted to kick him in the balls if he actually had them.
Wow. Because he was, wait, what, why did you, I'm completely confused right now. You wanted to kick him because he was singing the national anthem?
No, not because he was singing the national anthem.
Hey, Scoop, Kevin Carr's a communist.
No, because it's this weird little British choir boy singing this. Oh, say, God. It just sounded. I mean, they should have had Roseanne Barr.
Oh my God.
Singing the national anthem in that scene.
I'm starting to understand why you don't like this movie. Your expectations of what was supposed to happen are kind of all over the place, Kevin.
I was not expecting a sequel to The Dark Knight. I was expecting a sequel to Batman and Robin. Thank you very much.
Oh my God. Oh, oh, is this segment over yet?
Anyways, well, this review part is.
Woo.
Let's talk real quick. Well, first of all, Fat Guy's great. You know, you can say it sucks or it rocks or it kind of sucks or it kind of rocks. What say you? This is science.
Hey, no,
science.
It's a really definitive system. I'm really glad you cannot, put that in place.
You cannot argue with science, Brian. So what's your completely scientific review
of? I'm going to say it rocks, as the professors would say.
My opinion is that it kind of rocks. And you know, as evidenced by my discussion earlier. But still good. Still worth checking out.
Indeed.
Next, we're going to talk a little bit about the box office from last week, Ice Age 1. And it was $46 million, which wasn't great, but it was still put it on top. But it's doing incredibly well overseas.
Yeah, movies are tending to do better. I don't know what it is, man, but it seems like anymore... the balance of like how much a movie makes overseas versus here in the States and for a lot more mainstream movies is tilting.
I think it has more to do with the fact that there's just a greater penetration in the international marketplace now. You got China opening up. China's huge. And there's a big deal. I remember there was
I've heard
a big
that
deal.
About China.
Well, it's a little large. And they have great egg rolls. Mm. But no, I mean, they have bigger, you get more and more theaters. And it's, I think you're just getting better penetration in the marketplace, you know, for the tentpole movies.
Right.
So, and I think they're also making them with international minds. Like, if you watch The Dark Knight Rises, it feels like a European movie. It does not feel like an American movie.
I mean,
does that make any sense to you?
Are the animals like? Are the dinosaurs on mopeds going chow? Like, I don't.
Nobody's wearing. Nobody shaves their armpits.
Well, yeah, no, that's a given. Yeah.
No. It's just the pacing and the structure of it, and part of it's because you know there's a lot of British influence because you got Noel in there and everything like that. But it feels very. I don't know, just the pacing and the way it's put together.
Oh, you're talking about okay. I thought you were still talking about Ice Age.
No.
I was like, what feels European about Ice Age?
No. The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay.
Dark Knight Rises feels like a European movie. I think it felt more European than... And that's not why I didn't...
Well, that's because there's a bunch of Europeans in it.
Well, yeah, that too.
There's Tom Hardy, Christian Bale, Marion Cotillard.
There's not one goddamn American except
Gary
the black
Oldman.
Guy.
Yeah, like, most of the actors in that movie are European.
That's true. But Ice Age, the reason Ice Age does well overseas, I said this last week in reviewing it, when you watch the Ice Age movie, you don't actually have to understand the dialogue. If you watch the movie, you can get it without understanding what they're saying.
Cool, then I'll take my iPod with me.
And you can just like just talk over and make your own words to it. But that's the Ice Age does very well overseas. But what do you think is going to win this weekend? Do you think do you think that
it's going to be Dark Knight Rises? I mean, the hype alone in that movie is going to be enough to take down pretty much anything else. So.
Are you sure? You don't think that Madea's witness protection is going to pop up there and you know have a resurgence?
I'm not going to rule it out entirely. What I will say is that I doubt it.
Okay, you're taking a firm stance on that.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say that I'm pretty sure that's not going to happen.
Yeah, The Dark Knight Rises is going to win this week. And here's the big question. What do you think? Do you think it's going to... First of all, do you think it's going to top The Dark Knight's weekend take? And then second of all, do you think it's going to top The Avengers take?
Well, it's not going to top The Avengers take. The reason for that is because it didn't have the same... Like, don't get me wrong, we've been anticipating this movie for 4 years, but what Marvel did with The Avengers was to create a viral marketing campaign that involved making other movies as part of the marketing, which is genius. So, no, I don't, it doesn't have that same kind of buildup, so I don't see that happening. Plus, we have, as the general, that when I say we, I'm not talking about guys like you and me, I'm talking about the general movie-going public, kind of knows what to expect from a Christopher Nolan Batman movie. So there's not that same anticipation of, oh my god, they got all these heroes in one movie, this has never been done before, it's incredible, it's an event, blah, 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 blah. So I feel like it's going to do really well, it's going to make a lot of money, but I don't even think it'll probably top what The Dark Knight did.
Yeah, I think it's there's a couple things going. Well, part of the other reason why it's not going to beat the Avengers opening weekend is just first of all, it would have to sell 30% more tickets because it doesn't have the 3D bump. So from a just a pure grossing standpoint, it's got to actually do better than the Avengers to just equal the Avengers.
Right.
From a money standpoint, it's gonna have a huge. I will say this, it's gonna have one of the highest IMAX takes you've ever seen.
Sure.
Because it's really pushing the IMAX, and I mean to the point that even hear me, I'm kind of lukewarm on it. I'm still gonna go see it again in IMAX.
Yeah.
And pay to go see it, and I don't pay to see too many movies because I go to a lot of the screenings. So. It's rare for me to go and plop down
because you don't like to have a connection with the common man because that sullies your elite status.
Who wants to walk in with the unwashed masses?
Right,
I demand press only screenings. No, but also there tends to be this first out of the gate money issue with a lot of movies, and it's not 100% true. But think back to the summer of 2009. Wolverine was the first movie out of the gate, and it had the highest opening weekend, I think, of the summer. When you talk just 3-day weekend.
Yeah.
And it was Wolverine.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the summer that you had Star Trek, and you had the Transformers 2. You had other huge movies. And Wolverine, no one topped their opening weekend take. There tends to be that, let's wave the green flag in front of the cars and I'll get out there for that first one. So I think that the Avengers benefited from that.
Sure. Whereas Batman or The Dark Knight Rises is coming out in the dead center of summer. So,
well, and we've had two huge superhero movies already this summer. Plus The Dark Knight, it's the Avengers tends, both of them are 4-quadrant movies, but the Avengers dips farther into the kids area than, kids. You can take kids to see the Avengers, and they have a blast. Take them to see The Dark Knight; they might get a little bored.
Yeah, no, you're. I mean, that's very true, but that's kind of always been the difference for me between Marvel and DC, and why I tend to gravitate toward DC.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah, I think you're looking at probably 140 to 150 million for that first weekend.
That's not a bad estimate.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? It might do great. I don't know. We'll see. The next thing, we've got a question here from Thomas from Seattle, one of our listeners.
Hello, and Thomas.
Hello. Thomas is waiting for Christopher Nolan's Downfall, by the way, just to warn you. So
I would love to see him remake Downfall.
Or Falling Down.
Or Falling Down, yeah.
His question is, what does an M. Night Shyamalan comeback look like? What actor or director would you most like to see make a comeback? First of all, do you think that Shyamalan's going to have a comeback?
Well, I don't.
Do you think he's going to have one at all?
We won't know what an M. Night Shyamalan comeback looks like until the third act when it comes out of nowhere.
that's true.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll have a cameo in it at some point.
Yeah, I just think that guy's done. Like, it's funny. You watch The Happening and you realize that what you're actually seeing is not a film, but a filmmaker lose their mind on screen. Like, they've recorded a guy who's actually going insane. And I think that was continued with Last Airbender. I just don't think he can hack it anymore. Like, I just don't think he's got it.
You think that's just basically the version of the cray-cray ex-girlfriend on YouTube breaking down?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, I didn't actually use the words cray-cray in my review, but it was something very similar to that, I believe.
Yeah, I kind of have to agree. I happen to be a fan of M. Night Shyamalan. Now, I do not like The Last Airbender. That's a piece of shit. But I love The Happening. I loved Lady in the Water. I loved Signs. The only one I didn't like is the one that everyone says, oh, it's still good, is Unbreakable. I didn't like that.
Okay, just stop talking, Kevin Carr. You got to be kidding me. You just said everybody. I like The Happening. I don't like Unbreakable.
No, I think I said I loved The Happening.
Oh, you're right. You said you love The Happening and you don't like Unbreakable. Like, I feel like I'm losing my mind now. Like, I should film The Happening right now.
Stab yourself with a knitting needle.
Serious? I don't understand you. Like, I want to. I really do. Like, in the way that, like, Jane Goodall wants to understand her subject matter. But the thing is, like, when you say that you love The Happening and you don't like Unbreakable, I have to... Like, okay, when you say you love The Happening, do you love it in the way that I love it, where it's just like, I love the mess and the glorious failure that it is, or do you, like, legit love that movie?
To say I love it like I love a good old-fashioned Twilight Zone movie, a Twilight Zone episode. So, I mean, there's a certain level of, like, this is completely preposterous. But, I think the concept's really cool and chilling, and just it's just so... ballsy at times of just being the what the fuck potential is why I love The Happening, because it has lines that the dialogue's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, terrible dialogue, but it's awesome to watch.
I like to watch that movie just kind of on a junk food cinema level. I really do. But I dig that.
But here's what I
Unbreakable,
did,
so
this is what I didn't like about Unbreakable is it felt like after the success of The Sixth Sense, is he wanted to make another movie. And they said, no, okay, you can, but Bruce Willis has to be the star. You got to have this big twist at the end. It's got to have a kid in it that he's got a bond with. I mean, it just seemed like it had all these points. It had all these elements of The Sixth Sense. And it just felt like it kind of shoehorned it into that. And I would have liked to have seen it done as just its own movie. That was my issue with.
I don't know. I think those are just elements that appear in, oh, I don't know, a lot of fucking movies. So
what,
I
Bruce Willis and some shitty ass kid that
yes.
nobody gives a shit about.
Have you watched how many like Mercury Rising and The Kid? Like, there's a lot of movies that have Bruce Willis and a kid. Like, I don't feel like that was them trying to make The Sixth Sense again. I feel like that was M. Night Shyamalan like actually expressing his love for comic books and how he sees them as cultural mythology. Like, I love the concepts that are introduced in that movie, and I don't feel at all like it was just kind of like we need to crank something out there to capitalize on the success of The Sixth Sense.
Nah, it totally felt like that to me. Plus, I just thought it was also just such a, it was deliberately grim. Like, at points where I'm just like, you know what it's like, do you ever watch The Killing on is it AMC?
I've seen a few episodes.
I fucking hate The Killing because it's just like everything is depressing and dark and dreary. There's not a shred or an ounce of any sort of levity in everybody. And that's kind of what I felt like with the Sixth Sense, but Unbreakable. It was just so heavy. I was just like, it was unappealingly grim.
Well, no, that you're right. It doesn't have the same comedic timing as The Happening.
The Happening has great comedic timing. It's...
Oh, Kevin Carr.
It's a whole slice of awesomeness there. But no, I don't think he's going to make a comeback because I think he's kind of played himself out. I love his movies for the most part, but I don't see him. He might be able to make a comeback with like just individual like movies like The Devil or Devil.
Mm-hmm.
Where he kind of just like produces it and gets done on a small budget and it's kind of his idea. And to let it go there, and if he can scale it to the point where he's making movies for $10 million and they make 20, that's where I think he can do it. But I think his days of making $120 million movie grosses are over.
See, that's funny because I didn't even know Devil was a movie. I thought it was just a continuation of R. Kelly's Trapped in the Closet. Trapped in this elevator with the devil. So I pulled out my gun.
I think that line was in the movie.
There you go.
But we'll see. I don't know. We'll see. It could be. It could have, you know, Will Smith and Jaden Smith all over it. But God, I don't. Jaden Smith. There's somebody else I'd like to kick in the balls.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that kid.
I know he's like 12, but I still want to kick him in the balls.
Yeah, everybody talked about how great the Karate Kid remake was, and I saw it, and I was like, yeah, I don't like this kid. That's the difference, though, is I could root for Ralph Macchio. I can't root for this tiny little child that's getting his ass kicked. Like, I'm just like, I don't care. Like,
well, part of the thing is Ralph Macchio, even though he was kind of that street kid kind of demeanor, he was still very likable and, you know, charming on screen. You're just like, oh, well, that's just the way he talks, and that's kind of how he grew up. But yeah, Jaden Smith was just a punk.
Yeah. That so, he was.
Yeah, I that's why I didn't like. That's why I didn't like the Karate Kid. So I'm not a big fan of Jaden Smith. I think Jaden Smith's not a bad actor. I just don't think he warrants the roles he's getting that his dad's basically making for him.
Oh, who's his dad? No, I'm kidding.
I think it's Tom Selleck.
Woo! What?
What? It's Joe Paterno. It's anyways, Joe Paterno. is there an actor director you want to see make a comeback?
Absolutely. I desperately want to see Robert Forster do more movies. Wow. I think that guy is great. I think he's one of those actors that really understands the craft and does some great movies. And even when he's in movies that aren't that great, he's easily the best part of it. And I wish more studios would give him a chance. I mean, he was in Descendants and he was good in that. But I wish he did more stuff.
He seemed to have had that. He was one of those Quentin Tarantino comebacks that no one ever got behind.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't understand why not. Cause he was good in Jackie Brown. And I love him for movies like, Vigilante, which, by the way, that director, William Lustig, also needs to make a comeback because he hasn't made anything since, like, 97, I think. So
yeah.
I would like to see that happen as well.
Yeah, or Dragon Wars.
You had to bring up Dragon Wars.
D-War.
Yeah, well, he also did good movies, too.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm sure if I thought about it long enough. I've been thinking about this. I can't like come up with somebody where I'm like, I really want to see him make a comeback, because usually directors have their time and then they kind of like Rob Reiner in the 80s and early 90s was a freaking amazing director. And now he's making movies like, well, you know, like Alex and Emma and what's that?
New Year's
what was
Eve?
The last one? No, that's Gary Marshall.
Oh, that's Gary Marshall. Okay,
but no, he did. He was the one he did. It went like straight to video. It was about. It was like, oh, I forget what it was. It was the thing with the kids in the 60s and this little kid falling in love with his girl. It was. He makes crap movies now. He's terrible.
Yeah, he makes the kind of movies you can't even remember the names of.
Yeah, I can't. And like Penny Marshall. Penny Marshall had this string of just fantastic movies. And then she didn't. So
this is true.
I kind of don't want to encourage when a director has made their mark. Just let that mark stay.
Indeed.
So let's move on to the Fat Guy Five. And these are in honor of the Dark Knight. For at least for my opinion, I guess. Five movies that failed to live up to their hype, but were still okay.
You should really call this segment the combo meal. I mean, if we're really committed to the theme here.
Combo meal.
It's the combo meal. So what? It's movies that didn't live up to their hype. So what is first?
But are still okay. They're still enjoyable to watch. Yeah, the first one on the list is the Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which had huge build up, huge hype. Years of them trying to do a fourth Indiana Jones movie, and while it was a huge hit, you know, it was one of the top grossing movies of that summer, along with. The Dark Knight overdid that, but like Iron Man, the first Iron Man, were all up there with 300 and some million. It still got a lot of hatred from people, and a lot of people didn't quite live up to what people were expecting. I still enjoyed it for what it was. I understand why it was what it was. So that's one I think that it didn't quite live up to its hype, but I still enjoy watching it.
Hey, and that's great for you. I mean, some people enjoy getting. You know, their teeth removed with a pair of pliers.
Well,
and,
you know, of course.
And that's cool, too. But
you're not an Indiana Jones fan. Then,
I hate every frame of that movie with a burning, really? Fiery passion. Yes.
Every frame.
Every frame of that movie can wow. take a ride on my suck stick.
Wow.
Yes. I hate that movie. I think it didn't ruin. Like,
do not say it raped your childhood.
No, I'm not going to say that because that's a silly thing to say. And it didn't ruin the other Indiana Jones movies for me, but. The laziness and the lack of devotion to its own canon and the utter stupidity of that script. I'm just like, you know what, Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford, if you're too tired to do anything more exciting than run down steps, maybe you don't need to be in another Indiana Jones movie. I don't know.
But so you're basically championing Shia LaBeouf to take over.
No, I'm championing no more of those movies to ever be made ever again.
well, since Harrison Ford's 70, he just turned 70 this week.
This is true. I will go with, you know what, my choice will be, and this is a very recent one, would be The Amazing Spider-Man.
No.
Which is a movie that got a sensational amount of hype for a number of reasons. I mean, obviously, it's a comic book movie in this day and age, which means it's going to be marketed, you know, to the breaking point. But yeah, it was also a reboot of a franchise that had, you know, run its course not that long ago. So it's it's one of those weird situations where it's like we're rebooting a movie after only or a franchise after only a few years. And I enjoyed a lot of it, but it definitely was not the Spider-Man movie I was hoping for.
Yeah. I mean, I felt the same way about the Amazing Spider-Man as I did about The Dark Knight Rises, where I'm like, it's still good. It's still worth seeing. It's got some great things in it, but it wasn't as good as I thought it could have been.
Hmm. Well, I like The Dark Knight Rises a lot more than Amazing Spider-Man, but I don't hate it. I don't think it's a bad movie. I just think, for me, what
waste.
Well, you know what it is? It's like with Marvel, and I know that it's technically a Sony property, but it's within the Marvel, you know, movie universe.
Yeah.
And in this climate of success that they've been having, passable is just not acceptable. And I felt like that's what that movie was, is it was passable.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is I just watched earlier today, I watched the original Superman, the Richard Donner film.
Yes.
The original cut of it. Because that's what's available on Netflix.
Right.
And that's I forgot how well that movie holds up, how good that movie really is. That's a good quality film. And with the exception of a couple weird 70s kind of weird things, like the flying with Lois Lane and her basically slow rapping the song.
Well, there's that, and there's the fact that when he comes out of the phone booth, there's a Superfly pimp standing there. It's like, that's a bad costume, man!
It's a fine outfit!
What? What are you doing on my street?
Yeah, I mean, there's some weird shit going on there. But for the most part, it's still a good movie. And watching it, then it reminds me what a suck fest Superman Returns was. And just what a misfire in many ways. So, you know, we'll see. So I mean, it's if The Amazing Spider-Man felt more like a Superman Returns, I think Amazing Spider-Man is better than Superman Returns, but it felt like that in a lot of ways, where it wasn't as good. You got the next one.
Right on. Well, let's jump to another superhero movie of not too long ago, which is Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
And this, it's an interesting situation where it's like, we weren't prepared for how good the first Iron Man was. I mean, this was right at the time when they started to branch off a little bit from the characters that everybody knew. Iron Man, for a lot of the mainstream public, was like, well, maybe you've heard of that character, but you probably don't know anything about him.
Well, people didn't know if he was a robot, if he was really made of that. Or, you know, nobody knew anything about him.
Yeah, and that was the movie that made Iron Man an indelible part of our pop culture. Like, everybody knows Iron Man now, and a lot of that is due to Robert Downey's performance, and a lot of it is due to Favreau's directing. And it's a great movie. And then we're all excited for Iron Man 2, and it's not that good.
See, I actually liked Iron Man 2. I thought that and Iron Man 1, I liked them kind of equally.
I don't think we should date. I think we should see other people.
We need to just go our separate ways.
Indeed. I, you know what? There's a lot of Iron Man 2 that I like. Mm-hmm. And then there's the stuff where, to me, it feels like, oh, you know what? We got to cram Black Widow into the universe somewhere before the Avengers. So let's do the entirely unnecessary demon in a bottle storyline and put that in as the entire second act of the movie, where it just feels completely out of sorts. And the thing at the end, the battle at the end should have been more exciting. And I don't know, man. There's just so many things that feel like misfires to me in that movie.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I don't think I've watched it. I watched it among the other ones I watched right before the Avengers came out. I liked it, and I get what people are saying about S.H.I.E.L.D. The reason why I kind of forgive that whole S.H.I.E.L.D. shoehorned in is it had to go somewhere. I think it was necessary to at least kind of give the background of who they are and what they are, and it had to show up in one of the movies.
Right, but I mean, look at, like, that's the exact same mentality you take with Hawkeye, but look at the way they did Hawkeye and Thor, where he was literally, like, in the movie for 5 minutes. And it was fine. Like, by the time we got to the Avengers, he was still a kick-ass character. But it's like, they felt they needed to give an entire act to the Black Widow, and I'm just like, I don't think
they gave it as much to her as they gave it to her and Sam Jackson and Coulson. I think they kind of put that in as a whole shield. She showed up as a character.
Yeah, but I didn't feel it was an unnecessary character to me. Like, I, you know what? And part of that is
I'm not a big fan. She looks great in tight leather.
Yeah, I don't find Black Widow that interesting as a character. Like, I just don't think she's that interesting. And
see, here's the thing, that she's the only tits in the Avengers.
Yeah, that's true. She's the only T in the A, so
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I enjoyed Iron Man 2. I liked parts of Iron Man 2. I take Iron Man 2 very much like it fits in that. Watching them back to back, it flows a little bit better than just in that the movie does on its own.
Right.
Taken as its own. And there's another movie I can't remember what it was, but there was another movie that I saw recently. That felt like the same way that I'm like, oh, it seems much more logical to watch these movies back to back. Actually the last one on the list, we'll talk about it. You know, actually I'll throw that in there first. Quantum of Solace is the same way. That's another one on the list. It's a movie that had a lot of hype because Casino Royale was so good. And then a lot of people just fucking hate on Quantum of Solace.
Yeah. It's 'cause it's bad.
Like, no, it's actually not bad. I mean, it's not great. It's not the best Bond movie out there, but if you watch Casino Royale, Quantum Solace back to back, they actually fit better.
I would actually argue they it makes it worse, because my biggest problem with Quantum of Solace is that it doesn't. It makes you think that it's going to be this big like continuing revenge story, and it seems like it's going to develop things you've seen in Casino Royale, and it introduces elements of that. And you're like, oh, cool, I want to see where this goes. Oh, well, we're just abandoning that now. Okay.
I think that that's kind of part of the thing is they're trying to do with the Quantum organization. I think they're trying to make that the new Spectre.
Well, I get that, but I feel like there were avenues that they introduced that along those lines, and then just completely abandoned them. And I was more interested in that by far than about a villain whose ultimate goal, whose ultimate scheme is to raise the price of water in Uruguay almost double.
Well, but that's Bond villains.
That's not a Bond villain. That's somebody who's
the hell fucking, they are. They're totally
in a regulatory commission or some kind of utilities commission out to fight that guy. You don't send Britain's most powerful weapon.
Goldfinger, all he wanted to do was raise the price of gold.
Goldfinger attacked Fort Knox. There's a slight fucking difference.
No, I mean he's attacking the water supply of an entire desert. No, there's see, no here's the thing. Around. I just watched all 22 Bond movies in a row, and I didn't feel because I hear people just shit all over Quantum of Solace. So like one person said to me, he's like, "There's no Bond girls. There's no Bond theme. There's no action scene." I'm like, "It's got like three or four huge action set pieces. It's got two of the best Bond girls we've had in a while." Gemma Arterton and Olga Kurylenko, they're both awesome, and it has the theme. They throw the theme in at the end, but they muck around with that in Casino Royale.
Two things: one, the action set pieces would be good if they weren't edited on a sewing machine and shot so close you can't tell who's hitting who. And secondly, the James Bond theme in that song is fine, but the two people they got to sing it, their voices do not gel. Jack White and Alicia Keys should not be singing duets. They're not good together.
I'm not defending that. If it was there, it's not a good song, but there's some shit songs in the Bond. I mean, Tom Jones singing Thunderball was one of the weirdest Bond themes ever.
I don't even know what... Are you an alien?
Yes.
I love... Are you... Thunderball, Tom Jones, really? Like, you have a problem with that theme song?
Yes, because it's them saying, well, we want to do Shirley Bassey, but she's already done it. We're gonna get Tom Jones to do it. And it's him doing this weird Shirley Bassey thing, and it just doesn't.
No, it's him doing Tom Jones, dude. Come on.
No, I didn't like it. I didn't. That's what I didn't like.
You are crazy pants.
I am, but there you go. Or Madonna's for Die Another Day. That's okay, a shitty ass.
No one's gonna argue with you on that one.
They even gave her a part in the damn movie. What the fuck was she doing in that film?
I figured that's kind of the same thing as giving Tina Turner a role in Beyond Thunderdome because she's doing the theme song.
Actually, I thought Tina Turner was one of the best things in that movie.
In that movie? Yes.
Yeah, because, I mean, she was just so, again, for the what the fuck factor.
Totally.
So anyways, I'll stand behind Quantum of Solace. I think it's not bad at all. Here's the other thing. What's interesting with Bond is I remember about 10 years ago, it was the popular thing was just to shit all over Roger Moore. I mean, just like take your pants down and have a big White Castle Taco Bell shit on Roger Moore. And 10 years later, people are like, oh, no, Roger Moore. I actually had this conversation with somebody once, and they're like, well, no, Roger Moore was silly and all, but that was okay because that was about the time. And they're like, fuck Quantum of Solace. And I'm like, seriously, it's just because it's more recent.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the problem with Quantum of Solace is that it's silly. I think the problem with Quantum of Solace is that it was poorly constructed and felt like it was made the day after they finished Casino Royale, and they just kind of wrote it as they went along. So no, I don't think the problem is silliness at all. But I will say this about Roger Moore. I like up to about For Your Eyes Only Roger Moore. I think he's a different type of Bond, but I think he works until he starts to get ancient. And then it starts to go downhill.
He was too old during A View to a Kill, clearly.
He was too old. I would say, like, I honestly wish he would have retired after For Your Eyes Only. Because Octopussy, he's too old to be hitting on the chicks he's hitting on. And then it gets super creepy in A View to a Kill. It's just like, dude, you are way... Like, somebody tell Grandpa to stop hitting on the waitress. This is just creepy.
Well, I mean, but then Sean Connery came out and did Never Say Never Again, and he was pretty much just as old and creepy.
I don't acknowledge the existence of that movie.
But the other thing is, like, people like shit on Roger Moore because they're like, oh, it's silly and doesn't take itself seriously and it's all goofy and wacky. I'm like, have you seen Diamonds Are Forever?
Well, Live and Let Die is pretty fucking severe, I'd say.
Live and Let Die is very serious. For Your Eyes Only is very serious. Spy Who Loves Me, relatively serious.
Relatively, yeah.
I mean, Man with the Golden Gun's a little goofy, but he doesn't get real. He doesn't go off the rails until Moonraker.
Yeah, Moonraker. That's ill-advised. I haven't read that book, but yeah.
Well, that was just them saying, hey, Star Wars did well.
Yeah, let's find a book. Oh, wait, he goes into space in this one. All right.
Yeah. Well, because if you watch the end of Spy Who Loves Me, it's like, James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only, but not until we make Moonraker Firk because we had a big sci-fi movie came out the same year. So, I mean, Sean Connery's not infallible. I mean, like, the whole getting married in Japan scene. I mean, they say, we're going to, in You Only Live Twice, they're like, oh, we're gonna make you Japanese, and they just give him a bad wig and some eye makeup.
Oh, what are you talking about? He's totally Japanese in that movie.
She's about as Japanese as my dick.
Turning Japanese. I think it's turning Japanese. I really think so.
That's what he was doing the whole time.
Yep.
The last one is, and I will defend these, because it's obviously something that you...
Because somebody has to, I guess.
Someone has to. I like the Star Wars prequels, damn it. And they didn't, I will admit, they did not live up to their hype because they have some problems. But you know what's funny is, I think what's interesting with films is the box office of some movies isn't necessarily the result of that movie, but it's the result of the buildup to that movie. And, you know, the highest grossing of all the Star Wars prequels was Episode One. And I think even though that's the weakest of the three, it made all that money because everyone wanted to see the new Star Wars movie.
Yes, but that's insinuating that the problem with the prequels is that it was about the hype. And no, the problem with the prequels is that they are rancid goat shit.
I don't know about that.
I do, because they are.
No, I have a soft spot for the Star Wars prequels. They have issues, they have problems, but you know, there's nothing goofier. There's few things in the Star Wars prequels that you can point to that are any goofier than the Ewoks.
That is nah. Mm-hmm. No, see, the problem is, like, if the only problem with the Star Wars prequels is that they were goofy, that would be one thing. But they are fundamentally flawed in pretty much every aspect of filmmaking, I think, is maybe the bigger issue. And frankly, you defending them sounds like a battered wife being like, well, I know, but there's some good in him, and I really think I can change him.
Not at all. I mean, but if you talk story structure and stuff, Empire Strikes Back, Harold is the best of all the movies. Makes no goddamn sense.
I don't even want to hear this. Like,
I love it. I love him.
Don't get me wrong. I'm very flattered that you asked me to be on your show, but if you continue with this line of reasoning, I may reach through the computer and strangle the life out of you.
Well, how long does it take to become a Jedi Knight? Luke did it in the short amount of time he was at, and it was they both left Hoth at the same time. Luke goes and trains to be a Jedi Knight and goes meets him in Cloud City. The Millennium Falcon leaves at the same time, hides in an asteroid, goes to Cloud City, has dinner, gets captured. in like a weekend.
Okay.
Do you know, according to Lucasfilms, that's 6 weeks. They never change your clothes. Makes no
really?
Sense.
Really? This is what you, like, wow.
It makes no sense. It makes no sense if you think of it logically, but that's okay because it's a great movie.
It's so nitpicky. Like, you had to go to, like, the tiniest minutia of the film to complain about when you could go to anything in the prequels and go, okay, starting from frame one, this is completely wrong. This is completely wrong. Oh, it's a kid's movie? It's funny because it's about trade embargoes, so that's wrong. Let's
well,
do this.
You got C-3PO, suddenly quoting odds that he doesn't do in any of the other movies from beginning to end of any of them.
Or how about the fact that... I'm not going to do this. Because I seriously, if I could sit down for 5 seconds and write down everything that's wrong with the opening scene of episode one, it would trump all five of the nitpicky things that you could come up with for Empire Strikes Back.
I'm not saying Empire Strikes Back's a bad movie. I'm just saying that there's flaws throughout all six of the films. Granted, there's bigger ones in the prequels. I like the prequels. In some ways, I think they lived up to their hype. I still love them. I will recognize there's problems with them, but there's still some great things in them. And I love them dearly, and I will continue to love them probably. So, I mean, I just went and took my kids to go see Phantom Menace in 3D, and we all had a great time.
You know what? I think it's cool that you like the prequels, but I'm saying that because there's absolutely nothing I can do about it.
It's not like you could change my opinion.
I can't make your brain work properly, so I'm just going to say hooray for you for liking the prequels, because that's the nice guy that I am.
Let's move on to the honorable mentions. You've got one that you wanted to mention.
Yeah, this is not going to be one that I think too many people are familiar with, but about 4 years ago at Fantastic Fest here in Austin, it was like Fantastic Fest 4, I think it was, they showed a proof of concept trailer before a lot of the movies for this film called Iron Sky. Now,
no.
The proof of concept trailer gave us a little bit of the plot, which is it's a plot that supposes that when the Nazis were losing World War II, they actually were working on this secret space program, and they actually, a lot of them escaped to the moon and have been living on the moon since the end of World War II, developing their own society.
It's a documentary.
And now they're coming back. Yes, it's a documentary. And now they're coming back, and it was just like, wow, that's really cool out there, like, his like alternate history sci-fi that looks really interesting. And, you know, all we heard about for the next few years is like they're trying to get money to make it. We were all excited. They finally finished it. It came to South by Southwest. We watched it. And it was a slapstick, bad satire comedy with effects that looked like they were done by the Sci-Fi Channel.
Now, was it because that's what that somebody wanted when they finally got funding?
I don't know what it is, but what I'm saying is, like, in terms of like living up to an expectation, they created an expectation with that proof of concept that they definitely didn't even try to deliver on. And it, you know what? If it had been good at what it was doing, maybe it would have been forgivable. But even as a comedy, it doesn't work. As a comedy, it's rancid.
Was it something like Nine? Although Nine was, there wasn't a huge difference between the short film and the feature. It's just the feature went very Hollywood.
No, I think it's worse, dude. Like, it's hard for me to explain just how bad this movie is. Like, it really does feel like the Sci-Fi Channel decided, well, we're going to make comedies now. and they had, like, read a joke book once when they were kids, and that gave them some kind of authority on what was funny. And they like, watched CNN on mute, so they were like, now we understand satire.
Manborg? You've seen Manborg, haven't you?
Yeah, but Manborg, at least, like, I feel like there was an intentional sense to that. And this just felt like no one on the project knew what the hell they were doing.
They made a great... Well, but see, that's true. I mean, there's a lot of movies that make great trailers.
Yeah.
And aren't good movies.
This is very true. The Terminator Salvation trailer was amazing.
And not movie wasn't.
And the movie was not.
No, nowhere close. So you will not get me to disagree on that one.
Good, good. We can still
the other
friends.
One I want to mention is honorable mention. We'll get out of here is The Two Jakes, which actually isn't a bad movie. It's just a terrible movie watching almost 20 years removed from the original Chinatown film.
Yeah, that's a weird sequel to make in general, just because of the... First of all, Chinatown is not a story that lends itself well to a follow-up.
No.
And secondly, to do it that long after the original just seems like you probably should just let that one go.
Well, and it was also, I mean, it was made in the early, what, like 1990 or something like that. And so VHS had been around, but so you still had the availability, but not like you do now. You don't have all the instant and that sort of stuff. And Chinatown had kind of run its course. The Two Jakes is actually a really good movie if you watch it immediately after watching Chinatown.
By that you mean like build a time machine and create a universe where it came out right after Chinatown?
Go rent Chinatown, watch it, and then go rent The Two Jakes.
Okay.
Because there are plot points that directly link to it that if you have even spent a couple weeks between the two movies, you might forget.
Right.
They almost have to be played in succession.
See, that's what I said about Caddyshack and Caddyshack 2, so...
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there's you know, the art story arcs are just very tough to follow. I felt that about Butt Hunger Part 1 and Butt Hunger Part 2. I just didn't...
Yeah.
I missed the whole character.
Sure. No, absolutely.
Anyways, we probably should go to a break.
Let's do it.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are coming out of our infamous middle segment in which Brian realized he doesn't respect me at all for my opinions.
No, I mean, I'll still sleep with you, but I just don't respect you.
Yeah, I mean, well, who needs respect, really?
Aretha Franklin? I don't know.
I guess. anyways, we talked about Batman. We talked about The Dark Knight a little bit more. Dark Knight Rising a little bit more. We talked about our Fat Guy 5. We answered a listener voicemail. But now, what do we have coming up here?
Oh, I believe it's the world-famous DVD Roundup.
Oh, yeah!
Yeah, y'all.
That's right. First one, I'll let you go first since you're the guest.
Yeah. Why don't you show me some freaking consideration then?
That's right, man. Just get going.
Outland on Blu-ray, starring Sean Connery. It's basically High Noon in space, and it's a great little sci-fi movie by Peter Hyams.
Just shoot him up. Just shoot him up.
Indeed.
Yeah. I you know, it's been a while since I've seen that movie.
It's so good. It's one of those things that, like, it was right after Alien came out, and they were trying to capitalize in a lot of ways on the, like, the design of the ship and the suits is pretty much ripped off from the Nostromo, but then they were also bold enough to rip off High Noon and kind of come up with this weird Cobb salad of references to other things that works really well.
Cool. What else you got there?
Code of Silence, which is one of the only palatable Chuck Norris films. It's from the mid-80s. He plays a cop, kind of the one good cop in a corrupt system kind of a story.
Do not let Chuck Norris hear you diss Chuck Norris the way you just did.
Well, don't let him hear that you're gay either, because apparently there's a big problem with that. So that just hit Blu-ray. It's got a great villain in Henry Silva. It's got a lot of character actors you'll recognize, and it's a really cool movie, well-paced, a lot of great action sequences, but it's not his typical crap. It's actually pretty good.
It's not like Delta Force. It's not like the awesomeness.
It's so much better than Delta Force. It's not even funny.
Is it better than his TV show cartoon, Chuck Norris and the Karate Commandos?
No,
with 2Ks?
Of course not, because the human beings as a society have not created anything that is on par with the Karate Commandos.
That's such a great show. Paired up with Mr. T.
Totally.
Anyways, the ones I want to point out, we got Friends with Kids, which is a sort of a independent comedy. And there's also Casa. You know, you can go to Mexico with the videos this week because you got Casa de Mi Padre.
Yep.
Which is Will Ferrell, his homage to sort of like shoot 'em up spaghetti westerns or Mexican westerns. You've got Get the Gringo, which is... Mel Gibson's return to filmmaking. Actually, did you see the Get the Gringo?
I really liked it.
I really dug that movie. I was surprised at how much I think it would got a theatrical release, like a big, huge theatrical release. It would have been a disappointment. It could have made it in the theaters like in September or January. I think it would have done okay. But it's way better than your average direct-to-video thing.
Yeah, it feels like it exists in the same universe as Payback. Like, it feels like another Parker story.
Yeah,
I dig that about it.
Well, and the other one, or it's like if Martin Riggs had never met Roger Murdoch.
Yeah, what would have happened to him?
Yeah, because he ends up in a Mexican jail and has to get up. But no, it's actually a really good movie. I was surprised at how much I liked it. A
lot of fun.
There's also Lockout, which isn't a great movie at all, but it's one that I just keep wanting to watch again. And it's not a good movie.
It's not at all a good movie. It's a failure on every level. But
it's a terrible movie. But I kind of want to see the unrated version, because the PG-13 edited in the theaters was so choppy and obviously sanitized.
Yeah, totally. The rating must have been the problem.
Yeah. Invasion of the Body Snatchers on Blu-ray, the original with Kevin McCarthy.
Nice.
That's a fantastic
film. Wait. Hmm? The original with Kevin McCarthy? From the... Okay.
From 1956.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to make sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, because he was also in the remake.
Right, that's true.
1978. Ha-ha. Then there's also a couple TV shows. You've got Leverage Season 4, which is a neat little show on TNT. Sort of a Burn Notice with grifters. You got Eureka Season 5. It's the final season of Eureka. It just wrapped this last Monday, and now you can get the DVD. And Alphas Season 1, which is another sci-fi show.
And Adventure Time. Dropping.
Adventure Time, yeah.
Sure. Hell yeah, Adventure Time.
There's also the stinker of the week is The Three Stooges, which isn't as bad as it could have been.
It's really not.
I mean, it's forgivable, but it's just still not a great
movie. The stooging that they do, the imitations of the Stooges, is actually pretty good. Everything else kind of blows.
Yeah. They have this weird Jersey Shore diversion, which is just sad to watch.
That and all the Geico references. I didn't understand that either.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyways, we've got the review wrap-up. This week we talked about The Dark Knight Rises, the little independent film about the fuzzy bat. And Brian loved it. Brian thought it was great. He said he gave it a totally rocks. I gave it a kind of rocks. It wasn't as good as I was hoping it would be. Next week we have, of course, what's going to be the biggest movie of the summer, which is Step Up Revolution.
Hell yeah.
Will they dance? I don't know.
They better
dance. There's also The Watch, which I think is flying. It seems to me that's flying under the radar.
A little bit.
Yeah. And I don't know. Jury's out on that one. I'll have to go check that out next week. And then Ruby Sparks, which I don't quite know what to think of that.
I think that's a drink I order at my local bar.
Yeah. Either that or who you pick up on the way home. Hey. Anyways, FatGuysOfTheMovies.com is where to find us. You got about 30 seconds left, Brian. Tell everybody who you are, where they can find you, and where they can stalk you and all that good stuff.
Brian Salisbury, film critic, blogger for FilmSchoolRejects, Spill.com, Hollywood.com, and Movies.com, Fandango. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, Brian, for lowering your standards and being on our show.
Hey, you know what? Sometimes it's nice to consort with the groundlings.
Consort with somebody who doesn't know a doggone thing about film. Anyways, we will talk to you all later.
Like the show you just heard? Then head on over to FatGuysAtTheMovies.com to hear more. Fat Guys Network flagship show, Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The Idiot Boxers with Kevin and Merrill. Celluloid Spotlight with Merrill and Hash. And if you like any of what you hear, kick us a few bucks using the donation button on the sidebar. Or just leave us an iTunes review. Fat Guys Network is where the ooey-gooey podcasting goodness is at 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.